It's a joy for me to be back in this pulpit again. Reminds me of so many wonderful things and wonderful people. Many of those wonderful people, in fact, all of you are wonderful people, and you're here today, have inspired my life, changed my life, made me into a different person because of your gifts and the way you have encouraged me to dream on. We've gathered here today to celebrate 15 years of worship in this building. This building born of a small congregation that had an impossible dream, that dared greatly, and had the courage to build a temple fitting of its faith and its vision to the glory of their Lord and Creator. And I want to say that to celebrate the building is really to celebrate the people who made this happen. All those Don Quixotes with the impossible dream that came together so that we could be here today. A recent alumni magazine from Yale Divinity School is all about the visual arts and architecture in churches. One article decries modern church architecture as being without theology, without a message about God. Well, that may be true of the square little box buildings that are built somewhere with a steeple and have a few windows, but we'll be reading a portion of the Book of Confessions a little later in the service that speaks about architecture. It says, the arts, especially music and architecture, contribute to the worship of a congregation only when they help people to look beyond themselves to God and to the world, which is the object of His love. My God, can you people imagine any other church edifice that helps you look beyond yourself to God and look beyond yourself to the world than this one? Take a view. Take a look. That's why we built it this way. It was a theological statement. The whole focus of the architecture that we learned from a tent. When you don't have walls, you can see God. And you can see the world that God made. And you can love God and you can love that world. Let me take you back 15 years to what this church was like then. There were 135 members. Only 135, and there were 35 additional affiliate members who were members of other churches elsewhere, but combined with this church in the summertime. Now those 175 people, by the end of 1990, had pledged out of their own pockets and given to the building fund $894,684. Can you believe it? And 461,000 of that was already cash in the bank. Bids on the building construction had come in at $2.9 million, plus $285,000 for a pipe organ that was designed for this space up here. And the building committee had decided, don't have that much money. So what they did, they postponed the pipe organ and they cut $500,000 out of the construction. We had approved a $1.3 million loan from State Savings in Frankfurt. We'd received $450,000 in loans from the General Assembly and Synod. And we decided to try to raise another $200,000 before the completion of the building so we could complete more and more of it. Out of that 200,000, we ended up with 150,000. And Ron Scold wrote at the conclusion of his report from the building committee that year, and I quote him, "Miracles have happened and will continue to happen. Have faith." He was right. It was not long after that that the architect, Tom Ray, called and asked me to go to lunch with him. He said he'd been dreaming and had something to show me. And when we sat down at the Sale Inn, he reached in his pocket and he pulled this out. I've kept it ever since. Do you recognize it? It's this table right here. He said, "What would it be like if St. Andrew's had furnishings like this with the St. Andrew's cross at every one?" I said, "That's amazing." He said, "Do you think you can sell it?" Well, I went back to the session, and the session says, "Look here, Ned, we've spent enough money. We can't afford any more commitments," because it was going to cost another $75,000 to produce this furniture. And so I said, "Okay, I'll get my family to pay for it." And sure enough, your ushers there today, Phoebe and Roger Vance, bought this table. My children and I and my wife bought this pulpit. My sister, John Doan, was playing the ukulele, bought the lectern. And it was Marge French who said, "Oh, I can afford that little thing." So I went right back to the session. I said, "We got the money. Let's do it." They said, "Well, okay." And we did it. And here we have this gorgeous furniture here, all because of a dream. You see, that on that communion table there is the model that the architect made of the whole building. It was that went to the congregation. It was that I took to the Rotary Club. It was that I took to the Kiwanis Club. It was that I took everywhere where some people might want to support us. If you come up afterwards and take a close look at it, you'll notice that there are parts of that building that we had to cut out. We didn't have all the money we needed to put on the porte cochere, the drive-through that sticks out on that side over there. We didn't have enough money to do the deck. There was a deck we designed, and the wall for it is right there. It came out to this post here and had a glass railing and lining so that children wouldn't fall off, and we were going to use that for wedding receptions and picnics and all kinds of summer worship. Well, the porte cochere is still on the session's long list of things that we want to do someday, and you know, the foundations for that are out there because we didn't cut it from the plans until they'd gotten the foundations in. I wouldn't take much to do. And then I remember this pipe organ that we had designed by the Casavant Organ Company. It was a 25 rank organ. You know what a rank is? A rank is a set of pipes for each different voice of the organ. And there's 61 keys on an organ, so a rank is 61 pipes. And this organ that was designed was 25 ranks. That means 1,525 pipes. They're made out of lead, tin, and wood. And those pipes, we added up, were going to weigh 3 tons. And the architect said, "Oh my God, that thing will collapse." So the building committee went ahead and they spent an extra $30,000 putting in 3 huge steel beams in that ceiling. So whenever you people get around to putting that pipe organ up there, it's not going to collapse. I hope I live that long. We were dreaming. We loved to dream in this congregation. And dreams kept coming true for us because I remember the day after we decided to cancel the order for the pipe organ. I was feeling sad and depressed because I said, this space needs sound. We'd hired for another $25,000 an acoustic engineer who met with the architect and changed things all around so it would be the most resonant building in Benzie County. And every single musician that comes here says to me, I can't wait to come back. This is where I want to sing. This is where I want to play the trumpet. This is where I want to play the organ. Well, anyway, I went back to my desk in that small office and forwarded us by St. Philip's that next day after we canceled the organ contract. And I was feeling pretty bad, and the phone rang. And I picked up the phone, and it was the music director of the Catholic Church in Acme. The bishop had approved their buying a new $200,000 organ, and they had to get rid of the old one that was just 12 years old at that time, and would we take it off their hands for $15,000 if they provided 7 brand new speakers, which are lying on their backs up in there. Marilyn Scold was chair of the music committee, and we lost no time in visiting the church and hearing this old organ, and it's the one you hear today. People jumped forward to contribute to this opportunity, and Marilyn's mother covered more than half the cost. We were still dreaming. Dreams were still coming true. We didn't believe it had happened. Reminded me of the summer of 1998 when we were out in the tent over here worshiping and we had borrowed a Yamaha Clavinova, an electric piano organ. And I mentioned from the pulpit how nice it would be if we could afford to purchase it for $1,800. After the offering, an usher came down the aisle and handed me a note. The note had a check in it for $1,800. It was from a summer visitor who never came back again. A summer visitor, and the note just said, I just want to help out. Those are the kind of things that were happening. Could we not believe? Could we not dream? You know, it says in your little history, in your bulletin, about how we used the tent for meetings and for all kinds of things. And I remember we were having a worship committee meeting out in that tent, and I saw this man in a necktie with a briefcase walking across the lawn to the tent. I said, oh God, we're going to be sued. And that man came closer and closer, and I said, I've seen that man before. It turned out to be a classmate of mine from college who was a lawyer down in Grand Rapids. I hadn't seen him for 40 years. And he came up and he said, hey, this is a great thing you're doing here. I've been reading about it in the paper. And he said, my family and my friends down on Platte Lake, whom I'm visiting this weekend, wanted me to make sure that I had a chance to contribute to it. And he sat down and wrote me a check for $1,000. Never came to church, never came back, haven't seen him since. But that's the kind of thing that was happening. After I retired, I was called before the Committee on Ministry of the Presbytery that supervises ministers for the presbytery. They were giving me a debriefing after I retired, making sure I didn't cause any more trouble. And they wanted to know if I did not feel ashamed of leaving St. Andrew's with such a large debt. You know what I said to them? I said, what? I said, do you want to shame me for the encouraging of the building of the most beautiful and functional church in the Presbytery, if not in the state of Michigan? Those few people at St. Andrews coughed up over $1.5 million in 5 years to make that dream come true. And you think I should feel ashamed? Shame is a terrible thing. Shame is what we use to show our anger with other people, especially with our children. And it's a very destructive thing. Shame sticks with us. We don't know often the difference between guilt and shame. Guilt is when you make a mistake and you can make amends for it. Shame is when you're forced to think lesser of yourself because of something you've done. We ought to have a prayer of shame as well as a prayer of confession in the church, but we never got around to that. You know, so often in our relationships with our children, our spouses, and friends, we blame with shame. I'll never forget as a 12-year-old singing in the junior choir at the Second Presbyterian Church in Kansas City. It was our Sunday to perform. We were sitting up there in the chancel behind the pulpit, and the sermon was going on. And, of course, those of us who were 11 or 12 years old were pretty bored by that. So my friend sitting next to me was telling me a joke, and it turned out to be a really funny joke. And I suddenly burst out laughing right in the middle of the sermon. And you can imagine, everyone thought I was laughing at the sermon. And when I got home, my parents were quick to say, you should be ashamed of yourself. You've embarrassed us, your whole family. You've embarrassed everyone around us. See, shame is so often that tool of control and anger. The funny thing is, I don't remember anything else about singing in a choir at that church except that one incident. That shame got to me, and it gets to those who feel they are less than they should be. A social worker and counselor, Dr. Brené Brown, has written a recent book about this. It's called Daring Greatly. Daring Greatly. Because this sermon is not about the building. It's about having a vision and a dream and about the courage of pursuing that dream. It's about daring greatly. It's about recognizing holy ground when you're standing on it. It's about St. Andrew being at the feeding of the great crowd. It was Andrew in John's version of that wonderful story who located the resources. The boy with the 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And how fitting that when St. Andrew's, this church, goes out into the community to renew people's homes in the stamp program, it's St. Andrew's that locates the resources and makes them go around. That's what we do. And that's what we did when we built this building to the glory of God. We could have given up that effort. There were those saying, you don't want to borrow any money. Just build a nice pole barn with a steeple. But we took our few fish and loaves, the little we had, and we turned it into this magnificent structure. I'm amazed at what we were able to do with those few people. And then, as I said, the session said, hey, look, we spent too much. We can't ask people for any more money. And that sort of held for a few minutes. And then one of our members, who happens to be here this morning, came into the church on the second Sunday we worshiped here, and he looked down at the concrete floor, and he heard the terrible cacophony of the echo in here and so forth. He said, this church has to have a carpet. Within 2 weeks it did. And then the session changed. And then all the people who were saying, hey, we want to build a kitchen and a fellowship hall downstairs, drowned out those who said, you can't ask for any more money. But in 2001, we went out and raised another $500,000 from those same 175 people. The fish just kept multiplying. The loaves just kept coming out. And so now we have a kitchen, and now we have a fellowship hall. It's amazing, just amazing. Well, they dared greatly. And the daring greatly is what this sermon is really about. It's about what we do when we want to stick our necks out and make something happen in this world. And the book by that title comes from a speech by Theodore Roosevelt in which he said, "It is not the critic who counts, not the person who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better," and he could have added, "and where people ask for too much money." The credit belongs to the person who is actually in the arena, who strives valiantly, who at best knows in the end triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. So we're here to celebrate those people who dared greatly to construct this gorgeous building, and so many of you are here today. And we're here to say, for God's sake, don't stop dreaming. Dream on. Dream of what's next for this temple still undone. Dream what's next for the mission of this church. Dream what's next that can happen if you're committed to it. Dr. Brown concludes her book with a manifesto for parents. And when I read it, this manifesto of how to relate to your family in such a way that you leave out the shame and you teach people how to really deal with life, I thought I was reading the Sermon on the Mount. It could be the words of Jesus. It's part of what Jesus said to the crowds while they were eating the fish and loaves. And I hope, as Christians, we can say this kind of thing to each other as we worship together and work together, as well as we can say it to our children and to our spouses. This is the manifesto. Above all else, I want you to know that you are loved and lovable. I want you to engage with the world from a place of worthiness, like this church. You will learn that you are worthy of love, belonging, and joy every time you see me practice self-compassion and embrace my own imperfections. We will practice courage by showing up, by honoring vulnerability. We will share our stories of struggle and strength and failure. And you will learn accountability and respect by watching me make mistakes and make amends, and by watching how I ask for what I need and talk about how I feel. I want you to know joy, so together we will practice gratitude. I want you to feel joy, so together we will learn how to be vulnerable. When uncertainty and scarcity visit, you will be able to draw from the spirit that is a part of our everyday life. And together we will cry and face fear and grief. I will want to take away your pain, but instead I will sit with you and teach you how to feel it and be okay. And we will laugh, and we will sing, and we will dance, and we will create. We will always have permission to be ourselves with each other. And no matter what, you will always belong here. I recommend this manifesto as the vision of divine love that could be yours. Yours as a parent, yours as a friend, yours as a wife or husband. And that should be the message of this congregation to the world, as together we dream the impossible dream. We fight the unbeatable foe. We bear with unbearable sorrow. We run where the brave dare not go. We try to right the unrightable wrong, to love pure and chaste from afar, to try when our arms are too weary to reach the unreachable star. The people of St. Andrews 15 years ago did just this. They dared greatly, they dreamed greatly, they loved greatly, and their great courage is today our joy. Let us dream on. Dream on. Amen.